Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And wrap it up. Tell us what's on for today.
Yeah, I am here, although I'm not sure that my mind is entirely connected this morning. Things don't seem to have been going all that well with the producing of the program here. But first up, we have one of a great duo, Bruce and Mark, Bruce Weinstein and Mark Scarborough, and they just produced a wonderful book called Grain Mains, all about how to get whole grains, healthy, wonderful whole grains, in the center of the plate instead of just on the edge. Some great recipes and a fascinating subject, I'm sure you'll find.
The last time we talked to Bruce Weinstein, he was talking goats because he'd written a book called Goat Meat Cheese
Butter.
Milk, cheese.
Milk, cheese, and meat.
Now, just to prove that he's in many, many parts, he's gone mostly vegan.
Well, now he has meat friendly.
We're not giving up meat completely here.
Yeah, I understand we're not.
Well, anyhow, the title is great. How long it took you to think this up, but Grain Mains fall mainly in the plains. 101 surprising and satisfying whole grain recipes for every meal of the day. And I don't know, is it because you were in love with grains or you just saw a niche that needed to be filled?
Well, it's nice when it happens together, because there was a need, I think, for a book that took grains and moved them to the center of the plate rather than just side dishes, and I am in love with grains. So it was a great way to do something that I thought the world of cookbooks needed and something that I just adore. So in Grain Mains, we take all the whole grains that we could find, and everything is a main course, whether it's for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. It's not a book of side dishes. It's everything that make a whole meal.
But hold on a second. Now, you admit in the early part of the book that the concept of whole grain is really a lie.
Well,
because the grains are whole.
I mean, whole grain is almost, it's almost an oxymoron it is a lie. Most grains, to eat them, even as we say as a whole grain, you have to take the hull off, because the hull is on almost all grains inedible. So when you eat wheat berries, which is what we call a whole grain, and you eat oat groats, which get rolled out into oat flakes, all that, you're eating a whole grain, but the hull has been removed because it is inedible. There is, however, one grain that you can eat, hull and all, and you can even eat it raw, and that one is corn.
Oh, right.
Corn is the one grain you can eat entirely whole, hull and all, and you can even eat it raw.
Now, is it a different member of a different family, though?
Corn? Oh, it is. It is a grain.
It is absolutely
a grain.
Now, you addressed this issue early on in the book. The fastest growing segment of the specialty food trade is gluten-free. So, it is. It's billions of dollars in sales. And how many people now all of a sudden have celiac disease?
Well, if we really want to go by how many have celiac, there's not that many. But what other people tend to say is, I'm gluten intolerant. And it is possible there are many people who are gluten intolerant. But there seems to be this ongoing trend that people believe gluten-free equals healthier. And in reality, it's healthier for you if you get sick from gluten, sure. But if you have a normal digestive system and you can tolerate gluten, it is not healthier for you to eat gluten. It's not unhealthy. It's no need for it. Just like people think, well, sugar-free, that's got to be healthier. Fat-free, that's got to be healthier. Yeah. So now all of a sudden everyone's going, oh, gluten-free, that must be healthier.
It's not healthier unless
you can't tolerate gluten.
I mean, gluten is quite nutritious, right?
It's the protein. I mean, gluten is the protein that is found in wheat. So, yes, it is a very nutritious component of our diet. So, sure, it is something that if you cut it out, you're actually cutting out a protein source.
Some of these grains have gluten and some of them don't.
Gluten is a wheat. It is found in wheat. So grains that are varieties of wheat or related to wheat or crossbred with wheat are going to have certain amounts of gluten in them. So, you have to, and then depending on how sensitive you are, if you are actually intolerant to gluten, you have to be careful when you even eat grains that don't have gluten. Like oats, if they're processed in facilities that have processed wheat, you could get exposed to molecules of it, and if you're that sensitive, you need to watch out. But for most of us, gluten isn't an issue, and it is something that's actually quite nutritious in the grain. And nutrition in grains is something that what we wanted to do in this book was almost take it for granted. We wanted to be audacious enough to write a book on grains and, like, never talk about your colon. Because we want to talk about your mouth and how good they taste and how excellent grains are for cooking with and culinarily. They're amazing things that people don't know about. And the first thing people think is, oh, it keeps me regular. Well, yeah, that'll do that, fine. But let's talk about how amazing they are to eat and to cook with.
Yeah, I have to tell you, our grandson came in contact with quinoa for the first time, and he ate everything. He ate all the quinoa. He ate all the quinoa.
He ate everybody's quinoa.
Well, that's fantastic.
He never had it before.
It's a delicious thing, and it's got a fabulous texture, and you can introduce people, and especially kids, to these grains, not as, oh, this is something for you to eat, but this is just delicious food. This is just absolutely delicious food.
How many types of grains did you unearth?
Oh, well, we tried to cover a really wide range here. We broke it up by the corn family and the wheat family. The exact number?
Just roughly.
Roughly, I think we've got 15, 20. There's quite a bit. Millet, quinoa, oats, rye, buckwheat, Job's tears. It's a Japanese, mostly it's found in Japanese markets. They are usually refined a bit. You know what they're used for a lot around the world? Rosary beads. So a lot of rosary beads you'll find are just dried Job's tears. Very dry and starchy, almost like a black-eyed pea. Over the years they've been ground into medicinal teas and flowery powders. You don't need to soak them, which is a really nice thing. They have a great texture. They're one of the grains, though, that you don't want to cook way in advance. One of the things that I like to do is at the beginning of the week, cook up a whole bunch of grains, and there they are ready to make salads with all week. Job's tears don't survive all that well once they're cooked, so make them right to order.
Now, did we mention rice?
We have a lot of different kinds of rice in the book. We talk about black rice and
red rice a lot.
Most people only know brown rice if they're thinking about whole grain.
I love red rice.
Oh, I love red rice. And, of course, there's so many varieties of rice. There's Italian red rice, which is kind of a long grain, and the French, the south of France, Provençal red rice. And then there's Bhutanese red rice, which is a much shorter grain, and it has a completely different flavor. The world of rice, I mean, we could have written an entire book just on the kinds of rices that there are. And the one thing that I found interesting when we started researching rice is one of my favorites is green rice.
I never heard that.
And until I found that's not even a whole grain. So when you buy it, sometimes it's called bamboo rice, but it's not a whole grain rice. It's a polished white rice, but it's been treated with bamboo juice from the liquid pressed out of bamboo stalks to give it a green color.
That sounds disgusting. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's fabulous. When you make tamales and you steam them in corn husk and you absorb some of that flavor of the corn husk into the food? Well, it's the same thing with bamboo rice. It's just white rice that has this nutty kind of bamboo quality that's actually quite lovely. But unfortunately, it's not a whole grain. For that, you have to stick to your black rice and your red rice and your brown rice.
Now, you unearthed all kinds of varieties of wheat berry as well.
Well, there are two kinds of wheat berries. I mean, there's the red wheat berry and the white wheat berry, and there one would be sort of your soft white wheat berry and then your hard red wheat berry. It's just from the kind of wheat that's grown. Softer wheat tends to be used, has a lower gluten content. It's ground into more pastry flours. So it's the texture's slightly different on them, the color's slightly different, but they're fairly interchangeable in recipes. And I always say there, go for kind of the one you like best. Other whole wheat grains, as it were, like triticale. I mean, it's
what's that?
Triticale is a very, it's a very ancient grain. I'll tell you exactly what that is. It's pronounced triticale. It's a modern hybrid, first developed in Scotland. It's actually a cross between wheat and rye.
Oh, fine.
And rye is another one. I love rye berries because there is this flavor to them that does very much taste like rye bread. I mean, I love rye berries, and they also have sort of a bluish tint to them. They're beautiful. And one of my favorite recipes in Grain Mains uses rye berries, and I came up with this Reuben salad, where it's a deconstructed Reuben sandwich in salad form.
I'm for that
one. Instead of rye bread, I have rye berries, and there's sauerkraut, and there's cheese, and there's corned beef, and there's Russian dressing. It's just all tossed up into this big salad.
We're going to have to make that. Now, let's talk about this format. You start out, you give all kinds of general tips on techniques of cooking grains, yes and no's, I mean, do's and don'ts, rather, I guess. And as you go along with your recipes that are also informative as well as delicious,
you have
substitutions, you have tester's notes, you have a section called Chef It Up.
Mm-hmm.
What Chef It Up means?
Well, I think just throwing out a recipe on a page is lovely, but it's not enough. And so tester's notes are a great way for people reading the book and reading the recipes to just get a little insight of what happened, what was my take on it when I was doing certain things, a little history of the grain, a little history of the dish. Often recipes have, you know, what we call head notes, a little thing above it. Well, we wanted to not have head notes, so we put tester's notes at the end, which give you a little more information about the dish and maybe something you need to know about making it. And then substitutions, we do grain swaps, so that if you wanted to make this particular recipe, and I have my book open to Syrian Sliha, which I'll talk about in a second. If you wanted to substitute kamut for wheat berries, you could do that. So we tell you what a good substitute is. And Chef It Up, it's just a way to add something or substitute an ingredient to make it a little fancier and a little more professional. So in this Sliha recipe, one of my favorite, it's made with wheat berries and fennel seeds and pistachios and pine nuts and walnuts and pomegranate seeds and coconut.
Where
it's a Syrian dish. And
what,
you have to
what page
chew
is
it.
That?
That is on page 43. And it's a dish that's traditionally served at the teething of your first child because it reminds us to chew because you really have to chew this. It's just a fabulous dish, and the picture in the book kills me. It's so beautiful.
Which one is this? You say page 43?
41, sorry.
Robert, will you make that for me?
Isn't that beautiful?
Oh,
with the red pomegranate seeds and the green pistachio and the shredded white coconut and all those nuts.
Only
and
if
the,
you cut your first tooth.
If I cut my first tooth. I'm a little long in the first tooth.
Well, that's another good reason to have it. Still can.
Did you make up these recipes?
Every recipe in all of our books is mine. Many of them, I know, I did not invent Sliha. No, of course not. I mean, that is a dish that has been made for generations. This is my version of it. This is my take on it. It's my combination of nuts and wheat berries and fruit. So, yeah, all the recipes are created by me. I'm either inspired by very traditional recipes or inspired by things I've had in restaurants or sometimes just completely new, something I thought would be fantastic.
Now, you have another guy's name on the label.
So. Mark Scarborough is my partner in life as well as in work. And when it comes to our books, we have written, this is our 20th cookbook together.
You're kidding.
No. And, he is the writer and I'm the chef. And that is how we divide up our work.
Good. That works
well.
So he doesn't have any recipes until you give them to him.
He's got a lot of good ideas. In fact, I'll tell you how that Reuben salad was his idea, and we had a big fight over it because I thought it didn't sound very good at all. And he was insisting that it go in there and that we have to do it. So I came up with a way of doing it, and it is one of the favorites now. And I love it, and everybody that tries it loves it. And he came up with it. I mean, I created it and made it happen, but the idea was his.
It doesn't look very good, actually.
Oh, it's delicious.
I don't think a Reuben sandwich looks all that good either.
That's
one of my favorite foods.
Well, I mean, it tastes good.
Uh-huh.
But in terms of, is it really very attractive?
I see.
Well, I think so, but
if you think about it.
Well, Bruce, you are a genius, and I welcome this book. It just hits the spot with me and with a lot of other people on rediscovering these grains. It's called Way Beyond Bulgur.
It goes way beyond Bulgur, and one of the things I do want to say is that what we avoided in the book was flours and ground grains. This is all about the whole entire grains, not even ground up. So there may be a recipe or two where I'll use some kind of whole wheat flour, kamut flour, but that's ancillary to the other grain in the recipe.
Okay.
So these are about having the whole textural experience as well as the flavor of whole grains.
Well, thank you for sharing, Mark. Not Mark, he's Bruce, right?
Bruce, you keep calling him Mark.
Well, thank you, Mark.
Everybody calls me Mark.
Thank you, Mark, for sharing too, and especially for sharing Bruce.
Bruce, love talking to you again.
Me too. Thanks so
Can't
much.
Wait for the next one.
Thank you.
These two have been winners. So anyhow, let us know when you get the next one.
The next book out will be The Great American Slow Cooker Book. It is coming out in January of 2014, and it will have 720 recipes.
Oh, good. That's good.
That's what I'm in the middle of doing right now.
Okay. Our kids love their slow cooker. I've never used one. So.
You should get one. They're fabulous.
I like cooking in process. Yes, Peter, we'll stop.
No, I mean, we just seem to be starting off on a whole new interview, and I don't think we want to do that just yet.
Okay.
We won't have anything to do in January 2014 if we do it now.
Bruce, again, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be back right after this short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are back again. And if grain is not your best chew, let's talk to or let Amanda Cohen talk to us about dirt candy. What exactly is dirt candy, you might ask? And if you ask Amanda Cohen, she can tell you. What is it? Explain the name, Amanda.
Well, dirt candy is sort of our name for vegetables. We believe vegetables are candy from the earth. So it's quite natural for us to call them dirt candy. It's also the name of my restaurant.
Yeah, I like the fact that you say your restaurant is not a vegetarian. It is a vegetable restaurant.
There are lots of vegetarian restaurants out there. They do something a little bit different than what we do. We really focus only on vegetables here. And we felt that when I was opening the restaurant, there was this real sort of like niche that was missing. There are seafood restaurants and there are definitely steak restaurants. There was not a single restaurant in the entire country that was just dedicated to vegetables.
So what you're saying is you don't do disgusting things with tofu and other sort of protein replacements.
No, we don't really do any sort of mock meat. That has a place in other restaurants. Here we're really trying to sort of push the boundaries of what one can do with vegetables. We have a couple of tofu dishes, but they're straight up tofu.
I hated it Thanksgiving when I had family dinner, and I have a cousin who's a vegan, and she was delighted to have these fake turkey things. I thought they were just vile.
They didn't even look nice.
The real thing. It is.
Now, you have your restaurant. Where is it in Manhattan? Or is it in Manhattan?
Yeah, we're in the East Village, 430 East 9th Street, okay. Just off of Tompkins Square Park. We're in sort of the funky, cooler area of the city.
Okay, and you opened it when?
We opened the restaurant in October 2008. So it's been open for about 4 years.
So that's good track record here. And so it came time, of course, for you to write your first cookbook. Can you explain this cookbook to our listeners?
It's a graphic novel cookbook. It's half graphic novel, half comic book, half cookbook. It is the story of the restaurant, and it's all drawn out, and all the restaurant workers and our customers are characters in the book. As well as we have over 100 recipes from the restaurant, and they are also sort of drawn out comic style. So we hope that it's very easy to follow and read and make cookbooks
Well, now, how did you get the idea of doing it as a cartoon strip?
Well, about a year into the restaurant opening, we had a bunch of publishers and editors come to us and ask us to write a cookbook and to send them a proposal, and that they were very interested. And I was really against it. I felt that the restaurant hadn't been opened long enough to really write a dirt candy cookbook yet. And I wasn't sure that we had anything interesting to say, and I didn't want my focus to be taken away from the restaurant. And I really wanted, if we were to ever do a cookbook, for it to be really interesting and not sort of a run-of-the-mill, more traditional cookbook. And true story, my husband and I were having a big fight about it, and he sort of really wanted me to do a cookbook, and I really didn't. And I said, you know, there's nothing, what can we do to make this interesting? And he said, you should make it a comic book. You should make a comic book cookbook. And this is, we're in the middle of the street having a fight. And we both thought.
Hold on a second a minute. Does he work with you in the restaurant, or does he have a day job?
He doesn't. He's one of the co-authors on the book. He's a writer during the day.
Okay, and so you ended up brainstorming together, and then ultimately with the artist too?
Yeah, exactly. We came up with this idea. We just thought in our head that day, we saw how this could work, how we could really do something interesting. We found an artist who is amazing and who wanted to do it and was excited, and the three of us spent some time putting together a proposal. And we went back to all the publishers and editors, and Clarkson and Potter accepted it. And they said, yes, this is something we would love to do. Nothing like this has ever been done before, but we can sort of see your vision, and we think it would work.
Well, I mean, I think it's a roaring success. You get in there not only the history of your restaurant, but you get in there all kinds of issues, such as vegetarian, the whole history of eating vegetables only, and so forth. And techniques. You do a great job on describing techniques.
The graphic novel format is really good for packing in a lot of information and not a lot of space. So we try to touch on as many issues as possible, sort of give the reader a glimpse into what went into making this restaurant from thousands of years ago where vegetarianism started to now.
It's a ride. Now, are you as, strident as your cartoon character?
Cartoon character is based a lot in reality.
You must be a Lulu to deal with it. Although the one person who really just about undid you was your first contractor.
He did. My first contractor was his own cartoon character. He was a trip. He didn't know what he was doing, and he stole a lot of my money.
Yeah.
You didn't send him a copy of the book, I guess.
I haven't. I have no idea where he is.
Yeah, well,
I'm not sure I want him to see the book.
No, this other character that I'm fond of is your cartoon of Martha Stewart. Martha Stewart eating kimchi donuts. Did she say anything at all?
She did, actually. She was really sweet. She was really nice, but those were two of her true comments. You know, kimchi was very salty, and we were like, but it is salty. But we were just really excited she was in the restaurant at all. And the restaurant's very small. There's only 9 tables, and so you know when you come in, if you're a celebrity, everybody's going to notice who you are. And she was so gracious about it.
Uh-huh. That's true. I guess she would have been right there for the bait for anybody, right?
Right. And for about an hour and a half, everybody just sort of sat quietly and waited to see her reaction. It wasn't just me and my server. It was also the entire dining room. Does she like it? Does she not like it? What's happening?
Well, the other thing about this, I think, is the recipes are really interesting. And the food is interesting, very innovative, very creative, and interesting. So just pick out a couple of things. I mean, I like your whole section on pickles.
Well, we have a definite style at the restaurant. We take one vegetable, and we try to do as many different things as we can with that vegetable for one dish. Some of the recipes can sort of start to seem overwhelming. Like there's too many components. And we really tried to break it down for home cooks so that one could not necessarily make an entire recipe, but they could make parts of the recipe and still get the same feeling from the dish that they would have if they had eaten it at the restaurant. We definitely like experimenting. We like playing. We like showing people a carrot isn't just a carrot. But there's so much more to it, or that broccoli isn't just its florette, but you can make carpaccios with it. You can use the stem, and we certainly believe that you can use the entire part of a vegetable. There are no scraps here.
Is this true story about that you did appear on Orange Chef?
I did.
Looks like a nightmare.
Here at the restaurant opening, we did our we taped our Iron Chef episode.
And it looks just absolutely terrifying.
It was pretty terrifying. I think we were all sick up until when they started filming. And we're this tiny restaurant. We have 9 seats, and all of a sudden we get a call out of the blue from Iron Chef asking us to be the first vegetarian chef to compete. And we hadn't even been opened a year once they called us. So we were so flattered, but so overwhelmed.
Now, the competition also got to cook vegetables too?
Yeah. We knew it was going to be a vegetable battle. We didn't know that they were going to say it had to be vegetarian, but it ended up being definitely vegetarian on both sides.
And what was the surprise ingredient?
It was broccoli.
That's how you know a lot about broccoli, I guess, right?
Yes, exactly. We are experts in the field of broccoli now.
Now, you yourself are a vegetarian, right?
I'm actually not. No. I was a vegetarian for about 15 years or so.
Are you Canadian?
I am Canadian.
Okay. How did you think I guessed that?
I think I said about.
Yes. Right.
And I had been going out to a lot of fancy restaurants, and I had just sort of gotten overwhelmed with the vegetable plate. And this was a while ago. This was almost 9 years ago, where I don't think vegetables were as popular now as they were then, and chefs just kept giving me grilled vegetables on a plate some rice. And I really had this sort of moment where I realized I was never going to become a better chef if I couldn't taste what other chefs cared about. Uh-huh. So I really didn't want to eat meat or chicken, but I felt that I could probably eat fish. And so I started eating fish. And I think I've probably actually become a better chef because of it.
Well, now, what's the celebrity chef? Well, he's not there anymore, I guess, in San Francisco, the vegetarian place?
He was in Napa Valley.
Oh.
So I didn't move to.
Who?
Jeremy Fox was out in Boone.
Right,
Jeremy. Jeremy. Exactly. Now, he's not vegetarian either.
No.
Interesting. Run us through, to get some idea of your style, this celery salad, which appealed to me right away because I think it's probably the most underused vegetable known to man.
Well, I think at the restaurant, we all like to sort of celebrate the underdogs. So for us, celery is, like, people's reaction when they saw that we had a celery salad on the menu was, no, I don't like celery. I don't want to be here. I can't be in the same restaurant with this much celery. But with that recipe, what we really tried to do was show people that celery didn't have to be bitter. It was so much more than either just crunchy or, and most people's association with it is really this bitter, sort of almost acrid taste to it. And we wanted to find the sweetness in celery. And there was a couple of ways we could do that. We took the leaves of Chinese celery, which looks like a celery, but is much, much longer and thinner and has a huge head of green leaves.
Man.
And we make that into a pesto with some nuts, and it's really earthy and green, and just you understand that it's a celery pesto, but you're not reacting to any of the bitterness. And we slice celery really thinly, and just has a really nice sort of light acidy dressing on it, and that's really bringing out a lot of the sweetness in the celery, as well as taking away a lot of the toughness that people associate with it. I think people are also used to sort of chewing celery and chewing celery and chewing celery. And we wanted people to see that it can be quite sophisticated.
Now, is there anything unique and special about pairing beverages with vegetables?
You know, for us, we really we just serve wine and beer.
Uh-huh.
If we had more room, I think we'd actually really like to make a lot of vegetable-based drinks that we would serve.
Yeah, I could see that. That would be really cool, cocktails.
It would be great, and that is in the back of our mind if we open up a bigger place. But we have a teeny tiny little wine fridge that holds 8 bottles of wine. Just so nice to stick with it.
So typically, would you recommend, say, with the celery, for example?
For the celery, well, we have quite an eclectic wine list, and we really believe that most wines go with our food. So it doesn't have to just be white. It doesn't have to be just, you know, like the typical association with vegetables is usually a Riesling or a sweeter wine. we really like pairing all the vegetable dishes with slightly more acidic wines, and the red usually slightly spicier. We think that it's a really nice balance. With the celery, probably the most popular wine we had was an exceptionally dry wine from Italy. That was a gold muscateller. And the acidity of the wine was so good at bringing out that just inherent celery taste in the celery salad. And the celery salad was so good at balancing the acidity in the wine.
There you go. So you can approach it pretty much the same way you would pairing a wine with anything. You just have to think it through intelligently as to what flavors will go together and what flavors will contrast so sharply that they won't work.
Well, exactly. And that's one of the reasons we actually do tend to stay away from the sweeter white wine. I just feel that any time we try to pair them with our food in general, it's overwhelming. You end up with too much sweetness.
Yeah.
Okay, so the secret is dry and acid.
Yeah.
Now, who would have thought that kimchi would become some kind of iconic food item this year? Aren't you amazed that there's such an audience?
I think there's always a trend that people pick up on. And subconsciously, we all sort of do it without knowing we're picking up on the same trend. It's fun when you can find a food like kimchi that sort of has its base in tradition and... But there's so many variations of it and so much more you can do than just your sort of typical cabbage kimchi.
There are things I wish I had right now to eat, like your kimchi donuts with wild arugula. I have a garden full of wild arugula and cilantro. Salsa. Listen, I think that this is just such a unique book that we're coming into holiday season, and I think this would be a great gift. I mean, it's a change of pace for everybody to give this, and particularly for everybody to get a copy for his or her own self, because it's so enjoyable, so light, so refreshing, and really interesting flavors. Amanda, I wish you ongoing success with your restaurant. I can't wait to try it. And also
no,
with your cookbook.
You.
Oh, great.
Yeah, we just need about a 2-month lead time. Right?
Exactly.
And the website is dirtcandynyc.com.
Yep, exactly.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu. We wish you continued success.
Oh, well, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Amanda. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
And it's time for another break, but don't go away because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and we're making a short segue, I guess, from vegetables to vegetables and fruits. And a lady who not only writes an authoritative book on the subject called Jam On, but who also has a wonderful product line called, what is it, Anarchy in a Jar?
Right.
Gives you an idea that it might be something pretty interesting, and I'm sure you'll find it is.
Lena McCarthy book, Jam On, The Craft of Canning Fruit, starts out with a rather unusual sentence. It says, hanging off the beam of my forklift in the middle of winter in Antarctica, trying desperately to kick the frozen forks open as the wind bore down on me across the frozen ocean. I would have laughed incredulously had somebody told me that 5 years later I'd be running my own jam and jelly business in New York City. In specific, in Brooklyn, right, Lena?
Yes, exactly.
So that's how you opened this. How did this happen?
Just like life, right? Sometimes things happen in very funny ways, and I always made jam as a hobby. I learned from my mother, and then in my 20s, I started doing it on my own and experimenting and kind of learning recipes from different people I'd find and meet, from old farm ladies to chefs, and learning the ways that they did it, and then just developed into more of a hobby. And even through the time when I was working in Antarctica and traveling, and then I finally returned to the New York region and was working here and decided to just
see if it would work. You know, I started the company really as an experiment. I didn't know if it would be successful or if people would want the product or if I could make it happen. But then it took off.
Well, of course, you were young and adventurous, and so what did you have to lose? Nothing, right?
That's right, exactly. And especially because I started it really, truly from the ground up, there really wasn't anything to lose. Invest a huge amount of money in it. It was something I just started it and started selling it at markets and small food markets around New York City, and then it just started to grow. Naturally, it grew and eventually made it into a real viable business.
Well, it's a very excellent product, which is why it keeps
growing.
Thank you. Yeah, we had the blueberries that were just wonderful.
Ooh, nice.
It's worth commenting, listeners, that you probably get an idea that this is a somewhat unconventional business when you learn that the business is called Anarchy in a Jar.
And it means something. It means what to you? Anarchy in a Jar means what?
Well, it's funny. People ask me that all the time, and obviously the name is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I also think it represents the product and kind of what the aim of the product is, which is its unconventional flavors. Our technique is such that you really get a really intense, just fresh fruit flavor when you taste the jam. And I kind of wanted to do this. You know, the goal initially of the company was really to take a lot of the kind of classic American canning flavors. Anything, you can get great tasting, you know, fresh fruit at so many places around the country. And there's really a tradition, I think, in families of, you know, canning up, putting up your fruit from your own home and your backyard and your orchard, but also kind of taking some of the more of the European traditions of long maceration and using fresh herbs and a lot of kind of a little more unconventional flavor combinations.
Yeah, how about watermelon and lemongrass, which is jelly?
Oh, yeah. That flavor, that was really an experiment. I really wanted to, one of my goals, and I've been sitting at a really nice cocktail lounge in Brooklyn, and the bartender said to me that her one real challenge, and she's a pretty well-known, very amazing mixologist, and she said her one challenge was to make a great watermelon cocktail.
Uh-huh.
That she felt like she really struggled with those flavors, and it made me think that was something I could do with a jam. I could experiment with that jelly, and I think it's successful. It has a really amazing watermelon taste. The lemongrass adds just that little bit of kind of deepening flavor and exoticness to it.
Now, you mentioned jam and jelly and preserves and chutneys, and what else do you have in here?
Yeah, they're all different, and I think each one is its own kind of fun experimentation. I think I encourage people, especially when I teach jam classes, that they should not be afraid of other variations. But jelly, I think people have a really bad idea of jelly. You know, they think of it as those little packets that you get at a diner. But, of course, jelly can be amazing, and it's really just the juice of strained out fruit. So it's a really fun thing to play with. And you can add different things that kind of can float in the jelly, and it's a really fun platform for really intense flavor creations. And preserves are whole fruits that have been floating in the juices. And then jam, of course, is smashed up fruit. And then marmalade is also something that I think Americans sometimes tend to be a little afraid of. It's much more of a British tradition. But marmalade's a really fun flavor, especially as an adult with a more advanced palate where we like bitter things as we get older, I think. And that can be a really fun way. Yeah.
Peter's English, and his favorite thing is, of course, orange marmalade.
Well, grapefruit marmalade's pretty good, too. And you have a grapefruit marmalade with a rather unusual ingredient in it.
I do. But we add a little bit of smoked salt, which sounds kind of crazy, but just a little bit. And it actually balances some of the bitterness. It actually takes away a little of that bitterness by adding a little salt. And there's just a hint of smokiness. Favorite salt is actually the Malden, the classic Malden smoked sea salt, which tends to be less smoky. It's just a little bit of hint of smokiness there.
Well, when I was growing up, we never put sugar on grapefruit. We always put salt.
I think it's great. I think it's...
But you had to have a sweet grapefruit starting off with. Whereas in England, the grapefruit...
No, actually makes it sweeter.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
That's what you say.
We used to
get half grapefruits, and we would pile the sugar on. And then after the first sugar melted in the juice, we would put some more on.
but that's English with the sweet...
Well, there were also Mediterranean literal, really small grapefruit that are as bitter as all get out.
Yeah.
The kind you want for making marmalade.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Now, what distinguishes this book? I mean, I'm sure you know that this is not the only gin book out there.
You know, it's a really good question. I feel like when I first thought of doing a cookbook, I think my real goal was that the one thing I felt like was that a lot of cookbooks out there, there's so many great ones, so many great preserving cookbooks, and so many beautiful ones. Le Confiture, which is this Christine Ferber's King Gem cookbook, which is amazing. She's a French gem maker, and it's beautiful, beautiful recipes.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one.
But one of the things about many of those books is that they're a little too complicated, and I feel like they're a little bit less approachable. They're fun to read and look at, but I think for people who don't have an experience of cooking or aren't pro jam maker, and I think many of us here in the U.S. certainly haven't been raised, many people haven't been raised making jam with their moms. It's something maybe their grandmothers did, or they hear about, or they see, but the real fear that preserving and canning that you're going to kill someone. I mean, I hear that all the time from people,
yeah.
This fear of botulism, or that by making jam they're going to kill someone. And so I think my goal was to make it a little more approachable.
Yeah, I agree, because I did jam or jelly or any of that, but I get plenty of books about it. And I must say that I noticed right away your book is so much more straightforward and encouraging.
Well, thank you.
It sort of enables
yeah.
people to do that. And to experiment with it, too.
Exactly. And that's kind of one of the things I really wanted to do with the book, was encourage people to experiment. Every single recipe in the cookbook ends with a pairings section. So it ends with some suggestions for cheeses that you can use with it, or ways you can use it in other ways, stirring it into cocktails or using it as a glaze on roast chicken, things like that. So I really encourage people to think about jam as not just something that's scary and super fancy and very difficult to make, but really is something that you can make and play with and add different combinations to. Every chapter also ends with a make it your own section, which was kind
yes.
of fun, which is suggestions that people can do other flavors that really work well with those fruits.
Yeah,
so,
I
you
like
know.
That section.
Yeah.
You have pickled watermelon rind. My grandmother made that. And I
oh,
never,
nice.
But I never after my grandmother ever saw it again until I was working with the chef on a cookbook, and he had a recipe for pickled watermelon rind. So I think
nice.
It was kind of special.
It's a really old-fashioned classic recipe, but you really don't see it around that much. Rarely seen it for sale anywhere in a store.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine there's not a huge market for it.
Right, I know. But, you know, it's a real classic, like, southern thing, too, and it works so well with things like barbecue and, you know, ribs and things like that. It's definitely that cuisine is pretty popular nowadays. So I feel like I hope it has a nice market for people to play with as they're eating their fatty foods. They can eat some pickled watermelon, which really rounds out the balance in your mouth.
Well, now you have a business life as well as just writing this book, though. And let's not forget to talk a little bit about Anarchy in a Jar.
And, that's true, yes.
Here's the way you really deal with jam as good as Anarchy in a Jar. You open the jar, you get a spoon, and you spoon it out, and you eat it. You don't need a muffin, you don't need a bagel, you don't need bread or toast.
It's true, that's real anarchy.
you just spoon it into your mouth, and it tastes good. It tastes wonderful. So how do people get this?
Well, we sell it in stores all around New York City. It's also going to starting to be sold in Anthropology?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it's sometimes sold through Williams-Sonoma. They go through phases where they have it in stores.
Right.
So sometimes you can find it at Williams-Sonoma. And you can also buy it online. So we sell it through our company. And there's also a few other different companies, too, that sell it. So you can go to our website. There's a whole bunch of options of places you can buy it.
Now, the website is?
AnarchyInAJar.com.
And if you can't spell anarchyinajar.com, then you don't deserve to have any. So we're not going to spell it out for them, are we, Leanna?
No way.
Leanna, back to the book, is you go way beyond directions and supplies and sources for making just fruit jams. You do savory jams.
Yeah.
You do also syrups. And you do preserve figs. This is a huge, wide-ranging book. And you do risottos, you do cocktails,
yes, <everything.
laughs> shrubs, trifles.
Yeah.
And what are some of the other ones I thought was so funny? Roast chicken, pizza. How did you draw the line as to what you were going to include in this?
It's a really good question. Like, I could have gone on and on and on and written a million different things, I think, especially with pairings. Really, I like to say to people, you can pretty much put jam and jelly on almost anything, and it kind of makes it even more exciting. So I feel like I could have gone on and on, but I tried to keep it to just a select number of recipes, and then adding on the make it your own and things like that, where people can then there's almost like 10 recipes for each recipe, since there's all these different flavor combinations that I kind of offer. But I also wanted to give a little bit of a wider range too of options, so that you can, there's recipes for just simple jams, but there's also then recipes for things that are a little wilder, even things like, hot pepper jellies, and there's in marmalades, there's a sugar-free chapter, which is something people ask me about a lot. I think people are more and more conscious of not having too much sugar in their diet, but there's obviously many alternate ways you can make jams without sugar. That said, I do think sugar and jam is obviously sugar is an element of flavor. It really does bring out the flavors of the fruit, so certainly is, I think, the best way to make a jam. But if you can't have sugar, there's obviously other alternate ways you can use it. And then the wilder chapters of the pickled fruits. There's one of my favorites is Moroccan preserved lemons, are just amazing.
I collect recipes for preserved lemons, and I can't get over the fact that somebody will tell you it keeps in the refrigerator for a month, and then somebody will say you don't even have to refrigerate, and it stays on the shelf for 6 months.
I know, right? Isn't it funny? Things like that's like a really classic example of how preserves, the whole point of preserving something is to keep it. So, something like if you add enough salt to your preserved lemons and you make them in the right way, you totally don't have to refrigerate them. I mean, they might get a little slimy over time, but they're definitely something that you don't need to, and that's the whole point of them. They were made to be, they were kind of a pretty ancient technique of preserving fruit just in salt and adding that. So, but I just love them. I love putting them in everything. I mean, I put them in salad dressings. I probably eat preserved lemons like 5 times a week.
Really?
In something. I just love to throw them in things, and they really add just that nice hit of acid and that nice little bit of salt too.
Well, listen, get this book, Jam On. And Lena McCarthy will inspire you to actually express yourself through these many forms of fruit and preserves, and also treat yourself to anarchy in a jar. Are all the jars that little? Because my jar went really fast. Peter got the spoon.
we sell them in 4 ounce, those little jars, and also in larger. We have a few of our flavors that we sell in larger jars. We do. I like to say, though, it's kind of fun having the little jars, because then you can allow yourself to buy a few more. You can buy a few different flavors, and it's a little bit more exciting.
Well, I think you're on a great start here for a wonderful, thriving business and career, and enjoy Brooklyn.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you guys for having me on the show. It was a real pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, Lena, hopefully you'll come up with some more ideas and let us know.
Thank you so much.
And don't go away, because we'll have a final segment of today's program right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and we're going to now throw a little tasty history into the mix. This Andrew Smith is sort of the czar of single subject books, and he is intensely curious, and we benefit from all his curiosity in such books as this current one called American Tuna. We finally have a guest on the menu whose name I can easily pronounce. Smith, huh? Andrew Smith, you are the master of the single subject book, are you not?
It's a tough job. Somebody's got to do it.
What are some of your other books?
My first book was on history of the tomato, and then from that I proceeded all the way to ketchup, and from ketchup to soup, and then peanuts, and then turkeys. I mean, I've been everywhere.
Potatoes?
hamburgers. I simply became fascinated with the history of food about 30 years ago, and I started collecting a lot of material. And I thought a single food would be a good way to explore history in general and obviously the specific thing that I was looking at.
Did we mention here that the reason that Andy's talking to us today is that he has a new book out called American Tuna?
American Tuna.
I was hoping you'd mention that.
There you go. Okay. So this is his new book, and it's really a surprise to me. It was a surprise to me before as I started to read the book, to realize how much of the world's trade in tuna actually happened in the United States. Really, partly, I guess, because of its position in the ocean and the fact that the ocean waters off the coast just happened to have some of this wonderful fish swimming in it. But it's more complicated than that, isn't it?
Yes. I got into this for several reasons, but one of them was the fact that Americans didn't eat tuna in the until the 20th century, and that surprised me. I hadn't expected that. And
yeah,
then, of course,
I thought that was funny. I mean, why is that?
Well, if you've read the book, yes. You know, it's relatively complicated, but there's no easy answer to it other than the fact that there are a lot of other fish that Americans did eat, like cod and things of that sort,
right,
that were more prominent. So that's part of it. And then everyone considered tuna to be a trash fish, and also it was a real danger to fishermen. Bluefin tuna, which can be weigh as much as 1,000 or even 1,500 pounds, can go through the nets in the 19th century on one side, eat the fish on the inside, and then go out the other side and wave their flipper as they're heading off into the sunset.
I thought that was funny.
They're really conceived of as something you wanted to avoid, not something you wanted to catch.
Now, it's interesting. You mentioned that, in fact, one of the reasons also was that they were actually fairly hard to catch.
Well, the bluefin were extremely difficult to catch, and they really couldn't be caught until you had improvements in the net and hydraulic presses and things of that sort. So there were all sorts of reasons on why the large species of tuna were very difficult to catch. The albacore and skipjack, they're very small, and they're relatively easy to catch. And why Americans didn't eat those is unclear. Even after I've spent 10 years doing research for the book, I don't have a great answer for it. I do have what people said. They said it was too oily. They said
when you
cooked it, it turned an unpleasant color of brown, which I don't think so, but evidently people in the 19th century did.
Well, of course, it was the same thing with lobsters. They were so cheap, and they fed them to prison inmates.
Yeah, well, part of the problem was, I mean, we're talking real lobsters. We're talking 6 foot from claw to claw. And, of course, when lobsters get that big, they don't taste very good either. And it's only until later that people began to see that, hey, the smaller lobster of 3 or 4 pounds is really good.
Oh, did you write a book on that, too?
I was hoping you'd ask. No, I haven't. Other people have done a marvelous job on that. So, my goal is to really write something, write about things that other people haven't written about.
It's hard to believe there's anything left.
Well, let's go back, because this is a fascinating history lesson as well as a lesson in the rise and fall of a business.
It's called, by the way, The Rise and Fall of an Improbable Food. It's the subtitle.
So along the way, you talk about the early population of Native Americans and then the early settlers. Those are the ones, I guess, that you were talking about who said they necessarily didn't think that tuna tasted very good.
The indigenous people, at least on the West Coast, did eat tuna. There was no problem at all. And certainly Polynesians in Hawaii and American Samoa had no problem whatsoever eating tuna, and they ate it raw. So you really had some very small groups that consumed tuna, but they were minor compared with most other European Americans, those who did not come from the Mediterranean, just simply didn't have tuna in their diet.
But then you move into the phase where it became a sport. So tuna was, if you like, a game fish, and you hunted it with your rod and reel. It's really fascinating that one fish could so dominate and it could be so narrowly viewed.
I didn't know the history of sports fishing, and so that was one of the things that I enjoyed writing about. But it really, sports fishing starts with fresh water. I mean, historically, if you're a commercial fisherman on freshwater, you would go out with a net and you'd get as much fish as you could, or you'd throw dynamite into a lake and then just reap off the top whatever was there. And sports fishing began in what's today the United States, actually in the colonial era, about relatively well-to-do people who tried to get out of the cities during the summer months when disease hit the cities. And so you developed all of these techniques that said you had to give the fish a fighting chance and you had to have a rod and a reel and those other things. But it wasn't applied to saltwater fishing at all until the Catalina Tuna Club in the late 19th century began to say, let's apply the rules from freshwater fishing to saltwater, and that really is the beginning of sports fishing in the world. It simply starts because of trying to catch tuna.
Catch and release?
No, but there's lots of groups that are doing that today, and I think that's great. I mean, that's
demonstrates. Are
they doing it? Yes, yeah. Now, obviously, there are lots of fishermen who are going out catching as much fish and eating it or selling it to Japan if it's a bluefin. But there are people in that engage catch and release on tuna, and I think that's a great trend, right?
Now, then all of a sudden the game changes. Somebody has an ingenious idea to make tuna more attractive to the consumer.
I thought
that was a fascinating turn.
Yeah, beginning of migration into the United States of first from people from the Mediterranean, so they were Italian and in the former Yugoslavia and Portuguese,
yeah.
And they were very familiar with tuna. They ate it themselves, and so when they began to immigrate into the United States after the American Civil War, there was a group that was more than willing to eat it. On the West Coast, you had immigration of Japanese who also ate tuna. So you had immigrant groups that were going to be interested in buying tuna. So you had a small industry began in the late 19th century. But the question was, how do you make it appealing to broad Americans who have no idea what this fish is? Or if they do, they have negative views towards it. And that was the tuna canning industry that tried to figure out how they could prepare it and can it in a way that would be attractive to Americans. And so they figured out a way to get rid of the oil, and they figured out that if they only canned the white meat from initially albacore, that this would be more attractive and more appealing than doing the dark meat.
And
so that again,
these were Sicilians.
There were certainly some Sicilians in the tuna fishing industry, but the initial people were just people trying to make a buck, trying to figure out how they could can some food that would be easily accessible that Americans would buy.
And the answer is contained in just one short phrase, because and it actually became a brand, and it's really the answer: chicken of the sea.
It tastes like chicken, which I found that phrase absolutely fascinating. So I really went back in history and tried to figure out all of the products that have been used. People have described them as tasting like chicken, and there are dozens, which I didn't know when I started writing the book. But the point was, all you need to do with this canned tuna is use a normal chicken recipe and just substitute tuna for the chicken, and that's a good way to introduce it, and that worked.
So then it became a really big business.
In a very short period of time, in a 10-year period of time, the first can rolled off the assembly line in 1903. It was not a success for the first 4 or 5 years, and then they began figuring out how to brand it and how to sell it and how to promote it and how to distribute it, and within a period of 10 years, it became one of America's most common fish.
When did it become a diet?
That's the 1960s. And does a diet exist without canned tuna, tuna salad?
Now, I once, for Christmas, didn't know what to get the staff at my gym, and so I gave them large gift basket of canned tuna packed in water.
I will give you my opinion on that. Which
they loved it.
it's great for dieting, but in my personal opinion, it doesn't have much flavor.
No, and I think it's terrible.
No, I think
you can add
flavor.
I mean, you could add all sorts of things to flavor it up, but I really like canned tuna that's been canned in olive oil.
Olive oil, right.
It's delicious, and so I like canned tuna, and I still eat it today.
Well, we eat it a lot, too. We, of course, we have to have ours packed in water because one of us is constantly on a diet.
It's tough to be talking about food all the time and not eat.
Well, tell me about it. I've been doing it a long time.
Okay, so now we've got this phase where canning tuna is off the ground in the United States, and we have a huge fleet of American tuna boats that are quickly gobble up all the tuna off the coast of the United States, and then they have to head off elsewhere.
Right. The tuna was plentiful on the West Coast during the summertime, but tuna migrate, and so if you want to have a tuna fleet, what are you going to do with it? And as the fish disappeared even during the summer, then what you have to do is find out where they were migrating from, and that happened to be the tuna spawn in Baja California, and they spawn off the coast of Peru and Ecuador. So you begin to have the two clippers come online, and they traveled for hundreds and then thousands of miles picking up fish shifting their fish to a large mothership and then engaging in the industry in that way. So
essentially they were following the fish.
Yes, they were following the fish backwards. So they were figuring out where they were coming from, and that's where they were heading to do the fishing.
I missed that point along the way. Then you've got a number of interesting turns. And I guess we won't necessarily go through all of them, but the chapter about porpoise hunting is probably one of the ones that tugs the heartstrings most.
For whatever reason, in the eastern Pacific, yellowfin tuna associate with dolphins, and there is no good explanation for that. People have tried and have lots of different theories, but there's no reason for it. Now, in other words, where dolphins go, there are yellowfin underneath, or alternately, where yellowfin are, the dolphins are on the surface. But the good news for fishermen is that all you really need to do to find the yellowfin is find air-breathing dolphin, and then when you find them, just put your nets around the dolphin and then pull them up, and you will inevitably pull up yellowfin along with that. But, of course, then initially you had millions of dolphins dying in this process. So that became public, and although it had been going on since the 1930s, it became public in 1970 when America became really concerned with environment and with the preservation of mammals, particularly whales, of which dolphin are related to whales. So you have these laws that are in effect, and you had some really good promotions on television talking about this, and it concerned a lot of people. It still does.
I think it's a really nice thing. It's an early example of people actually caring about where their food comes from. I thought that was kind of intriguing. As if that wasn't enough of a problem along the way, and then you get to the next problem that maybe these tuna that you eat is really befouled with mercury, and that's a bad thing too.
Well, this is a little more complex than what I thought when I initially started writing the book. Your body handles small amounts of mercury relatively well. It's a metal, and it'll go into your body, and in a couple days later, it'll go out. But methylmercury, which is an organic compound, gets into your body, and it remains there for at least 50 days. And so if it builds up over time, then you have mercury poisoning, and that's when the problems really start coming up. So they're beginning also in the 1970s, same time with the dolphins, the scientists began looking at canned tuna and concluding that the methylmercury in the canned tuna, the white tuna in particular, could be a potential health threat. And so for 50 years, or 4 years now, there's been deep discussion on that, both as federal policy and the FDA making decisions as to how much methylmercury can be in tuna, and scientists trying to figure out how much methylmercury people can consume. And the latest research, or at least my conclusions based on the latest research, is for adults, unless you're eating 50 cans of white tuna a day, you're not going to have any problem. But there is legitimate concern that that for pregnant women, I would be on the safe side and advise pregnant women not to eat white tuna. The mixed tuna and other types of tuna are fine, but the white tuna is not.
Yeah.
But it's a perception, isn't it? I mean, it's not reality. It doesn't matter. It's the perception that matters.
No, it's a reality that matters.
Well, it's both.
Reality
is that the fetus can't easily get rid of the methylmercury. So if it gets into the mother's system, it'll get into the fetus. And the concern is that there will be developmental issues that come out of that. And so there's no proof, no significant research, but a lot of research that suggests that could be a very serious possibility. And there are a lot of other good fish that are out there that you can consume that don't have methylmercury in them, have all of the nutrients that you need. So that at least to me was my conclusion on looking at this very complex research.
Well, now, where are we today? Today, to cut a long story short, as they say, all the tuna canneries in the United States and its possessions overseas are closed, I think, practically.
All the major canneries have closed down in continental United States and almost all within the American territories as well. There are some boutique canneries that continue to operate, and they put out some very good products, but 95% of the tuna that Americans eat today is caught elsewhere in the world and canned elsewhere in the world and shipped in.
Now, where does it go? Where is the future?
Well, that's a good question. There's lots of different issues with regard to future. The amount of tuna that Americans have consumed over the last 30 years has declined, and what was once America's number one seafood now ranks number two, and if the decline continues, that may even be less so. And part of it is because of the dolphin concern and methylmercury concern, and also it's a part of sustainability. The bluefin, 80% of the Atlantic bluefin are no longer around that were there 40 years ago. And so there's lots of different concerns on tuna consumption. On the other hand, most of the canned tuna is albacore and a skipjack, and those populations are not stressed, and you don't catch dolphins along when you're catching albacore or skipjack. So I think there's a future in tuna, but just not the way it was 50 years ago when American tuna ruled the sea.
Well, it's a fascinating story. Thank you so much for all the work that you put into creating it and really teaching us an interesting lesson about something I think we thought we knew a little bit about, but it turns out that we really didn't know. and now we do. And so, listeners, if you like tuna, or even if you don't,
you'll like the book.
This is a good read. It's one of those you won't be able to put down, as I was telling Andy before he came on the air. I've been losing sleep over reading his book, just because it's filled with such fascinating insights. So be sure to get back to us again when you have another new adventure, another new single ingredient.
I was hoping you'd ask.
We'd love to talk to you again. Oh, you have one coming already?
I do. I have a new book coming out in October and another one in November.
What is it, Andrew?
My October book is called Drinking History, and it looks at both alcoholic and non-alcoholic beverages in American history, and that will be out on October 15th. And on November 15th, we have the release party for the second edition of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America, of which I'm the editor-in-chief.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be a fun fall.
In that case,
I mean, I haven't got any notice. What is the, who's the publisher for this?
The Drinking History book, it's Columbia University Press.
Okay.
And it's a complementary to my Eating History book. So they both look at American history and look at food in one case and beverages in the other case and how they all interrelate. And, of course, the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America is Oxford University Press.
We'll be talking to you again soon, I'm sure, but don't tell us any more about them, otherwise we won't be able to interview you again.
Not a problem. Look forward to it.
Thanks, Andrew.
Andy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Who knew there was such a story about tuna? I didn't know, and I didn't know how important it was in the history of the United States. I also didn't know, in fact, that when we were eating tunny fish in England, it was the same thing. So anyway, we hope you enjoyed today's program, and you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.